Okay, Dr. Green. Okay, we're ready to begin.
Good afternoon. I'm sorry I didn't turn up last week. I thought it was really this week. And we have been having a very bad time in the City University this whole year, I don't know why, with the open enrollment for students, as you know. It's been one of the most serious problems in the whole City University complex. I thought I wasn't going to make it today, but just coming from the Goodman College and the same question. Last week, I suggested that we should have this workshop this afternoon to sort of a general discussion type of seminar today, mostly dealing with how to teach the materials that we have today at our disposal, how to be able to evaluate some of the information that we have at our disposal that are put out by the companies, the publishing companies, and so forth. What kind of books are really the best books that we consider people and teachers, especially communities, people who are involved in education, and teachers should use in the classroom, and how to fit the whole African experience and the Black contribution in the entire curriculum of the social science curriculum we have it today here. I brought you this afternoon a bibliography that we have been working on with some friends called the A Heritage Bibliography for Parents and Teachers. Now, I would suggest that if you have a library here, you ask your business manager to get all the books that are in this bibliography here in your library. And if you don't have a library, you can probably check off some of the books that I think are very important and valuable. And then I'll leave you with a copy of this bibliography for your various public relations department to work on and make duplicates of the same bibliography and then circulate it, distribute it all over the school here, the five floors that you have among the teachers and people who are involved in education. Then I have also an additional information that we did when I was with the South Bronx Educational Center on contributions made by great Afro-American scholars and scientists and so forth. This is a very short thing. You can also reproduce this on your cyclostyle machines and see how you can be able to use it later after we talk about it. Last week I had an occasion which I was very fortunate to have had an occasion of talking to a group of students who have been groping around with the whole problem of how to teach Africa, considering the fact that today, even if we talk about the Black contribution and the presence of the Afro-American people in the United States, there is still a great deal of information that has been expunged from textbooks, from history books, and so forth. As a result, whenever we pick up textbooks, for instance, or history books, and other information materials, references are made to the presence of the Afro-American people in general. But still, these references are just made in a perfunctory type of manner. In other words, when we teach about the history of slavery, the slave trade, we really don't talk about slavery in depth, what had happened, the horrors of slavery, the obnoxiousness of slavery as an institution that men ever concocted against fellow men. When you talk about the role of the Afro-American participation, say, in the Civil War, we still just dwell, you know, like passing through. And you follow this highway or freeway, as they call them in California, of thoughts and information. And at the end of this highway, you find that when you look around to see the Afro-American, he is really an invisible person in the whole mainstream of American life. And the students that are talking to him and they're discussing with this whole problem were a little bit concerned as to where did this start and how did it start, how can it be corrected. So I had with me a record which I think we should try to jot down. It's the title is The Origin of Man in Africa. It's by William Campbell and somebody else. This is a very short record that is put together. You can get it from the World Affairs Bookstore in the Carnegie Endowment Building on 46th Street and 1st Avenue near the U.S. And it's the only place where I've seen that record. William Campbell. No, I don't have it with me. The name of this record. This record deals mostly with the origin of man in Africa. In fact, the very interesting thing about it, and I think it is quite humorous, is the fact that for the first time they tell us that we were all black. How do you like that? It is based on the work of Dr. Leakey, one of the greatest British archaeologists who has lived in Africa for a long time and has worked in the Olduvai Gorge, that is generally referred to as the Rift Valley, in Tanzania and Kenya. Leakey has, since 1930s right through the present time, been making fantastic discoveries of fossils that have been found in the Olduvai Gorge or the Rift Valley in East Africa. And this record is based on his theory that what he has discovered in East Africa, predates all the fossils that have been so far recorded in human history. And he has developed a theory that from this discovery of his, it is obvious that man first existed in Africa and that somehow we spread around the world. And as we spread farther and farther the globe, we began to go through a kind of mutation. And I've been wondering why Afro-Americans haven't gone through this mutation, having been here for 500 years. But anyway, Leakey says, as we spread around the globe and began to be, you have a very much, really, you find Africans looking like you in the question.
I believe that you have black people are whiter than so-called white people.
Right. I'll touch on that. But anyway, that the farther we went, the more we changed depending on the climatical conditions that we found ourselves living under. And they go on to develop a lesson plan out of this whole history of archaeology, and to bring also to the attention of teachers and children how we can be able to use modern sciences, even in our classrooms today, to be able to relate whatever we have. Even if we are teaching chemistry, for instance, a great deal of chemistry was used by Leakey in his work, and many other things. And then we trace that whole history of the origin of man in Africa coming back over to the Western Hemisphere. That stereotype that really developed around the black man did not just start in the Western Hemisphere. They started long before the black people were brought over to the Western Hemisphere. And that the best thing that we have to start with is to put Africa first in its true perspective in terms of the development of the whole human civilization. And we found that by so doing, by the time we come to dealing with the contributions and the presence of Afro-Americans in the United States or in the Western Hemisphere, then we can be able to deal with the stereotypes that have been developed by people in this part of the world against black people much easier, because the picture, at least in the background, is cleared as far as Africa is concerned. the role that Africa played in ancient times right through the ages to the present time. Eventually we came down, of course, to breaking down some of the things that we thought teachers are confronted with in the classrooms today. The first thing that we have in the classroom, and as you have seen during the last teacher strikes, for instance, a very serious polarization has taken place between white and black, mostly between Jewish people and black people. Some people have tried to exaggerate this polarization, that somehow we are moving in different directions and thereby we are heading for a conflagration. I don't buy that kind of theory. I think that is wrong. We needed to be polarized to be able to see ourselves as we look to ourselves and as we see ourselves rather than trying to have other people interpret us to ourselves as we are. And I think this polarization somehow was very needed in creating a kind of comfortable atmosphere and an uncomfortable atmosphere within which we can have really confrontation that eventually is going to put ourselves together. We dealt with few questions and the question of Ghana came up. We discussed about Ghana, for instance, in the context of the present curriculum on Afro-American and so forth and black studies. I presented a position that in dealing with Ghana, sometimes it is better if we can get away or digress from the touristic presentation of Africa, even when we are dealing with ancient Africa. And at the same time be able to see whether in bringing out the kind of Ghana that existed at the height of the Ghanaian civilization, we'll be able to inculcate in the minds of children certain positive factors that are going to enable them to develop a sense of appreciation of what Ghana was, where Ghana was in Africa, what Ghana did, or the people of Ghana did when they were at the height of their civilization. And then I touch on the question of when a teacher is teaching, for instance, modern communication today, like, for instance, you're confronted with a lesson in telecommunication. How do we teach a lesson in telecommunication in an American classroom where you have black children and white children all together wanting to know what has happened to bring about this fantastic technological communication between human beings? And how do you teach such a sensitive lesson that is surrounded by so many theories, ideas, and stereotypes that go back to the fact that this kind of telephone communication was created by white people? And in the classroom, which can make black children shrink a little bit or probably become introspective. Is it enough for us to start a lesson, for instance, in telecommunications, just where Bell Telephone started?
Mm-hmm. I think as with all other inventions, our children have to realize and have to be developed carefully that none of our modern technology just exists by itself. For the invention of the wheel, or the discovery of the use of the wheel, was as great for that period as almost man coming to the moon's man, or certainly the airplane. And that would be true in all communication systems. You have to go way back and historically.
Yes.
All manner of communication.
Yeah, that's really beautiful. But you see, the kind of education that we have had has really not been able to take us so far back to be able to understand this. There are very few teachers that we have who really understand the early backgrounds and civilizations of people in general. Those who have been able to present such civilizations and contributions, we are doubting their knowledge to what is happening today. Those who have made their own efforts in trying to do readings on their own and so forth. One thing has been an individual type of endeavor to want to know and to be able to give children the best that they want to give, which reflects themselves because they are concerned with the best. And I think we find this all over, even the United States, around the young teachers. Now, you mentioned something about their will. You know, there is a very interesting team of archaeologists who have just uncovered two ancient cities in the northern part of Upper Volga, where they have discovered a chariot that predates the Chinese two-wheel chariot, because that one had three wheels. They are still working on it up in the Upper Volga. Now that's really very remarkable, because that's going to bring out some fantastic evidence in terms of history, you know, and how we have been able to develop today. We have airplanes, they don't have just two wheels, they have at least three wheels, and maybe we can be able to trace something back to that and be able to make a very remarkable lesson, you know, for children in our classroom. But what I was trying to say is that even when we teach, for instance, say telecommunications to our children today, we go back to the ancient civilizations of people and cultures, we find that way back in Africa, and especially in the Empire of Ghana, the ancient Empire of Ghana, the people there had developed what is called the talking drums. Now, the talking drums are really not found all over Africa. So, tourists have tendencies of trying to bring back things and just labeling them African, you know. These are talking drums in Africa. And all Africans use talking drums. I come from people who don't know how to play a drum, but they are Africans. We are only concerned with one thing, and that is to feed our people. And we take care of cattle. That's our specialty. We just breed cattle. Apparently we are feeding in Texas, which we are transplanted to this continent. We eat a whole cow in one day. And we drink milk and we are sufficient. We don't take your vegetables and things like that. That's beautiful again. We have other things that are probably also beautiful that we can be able to contribute. But anyway, going back to this whole question of the talking drum, you find that you can develop a very beautiful lesson in telecommunications when you're presenting to children today, especially when this kind of knowledge is needed by our children. Because they are defying us in the classroom, because they feel that what we give them is very limited. Again, we can talk about, you have heard quite a lot about, you know, Aesop's fables, for instance. And we have seen the history being, you know, around Aesop and so forth. And maybe we go back. Now, instead of teaching a Jewish child that Aesop was a Greek, you know, maybe we should be very forthright to tell the history of what has happened for the Grecians to be able to claim Aesop as a Greek, you know, and all the kids can benefit from this kind of knowledge. And, you know, we trace all these things right back to Africa, especially since we are more interested with Africa today. The lesson plan that, you know, I made a little example of a lesson plan for you on Ghana that you can cyclostyle later and be able to spread it around your teachers who are involved in this, you know, field. I have labeled it June Lesson Plan, African History and Culture, that was Ghana. The aim of the lesson in the first place is to familiarize people with the historical choice of new nation's names. Boom. Now that alone can take you a whole period, you know, the whole day, when you talk about why some of these countries were at one time in their history known as Gold Coast, and they are known, or Tanganyika, they are known as Tanzania today, or they are known as Ghana today. That alone can be able to enable you to develop a whole lesson plan in history and the culture of the people of today. We'll be able to touch on it. And then we have the question of motivation. That again brings in the question of what really, for what was Ghana named? The ancient Ghana and the present Ghana. We have two lessons on the side there. Explaining ancient Ghana, what it was named after, and then the present Ghana, why it was named Ghana and not the name just Gold Coast. Why was the name Ghana chosen by the people of this new nation of Ghana, for instance, in 1967? Then I have number three here, place on bulletin board features of size and personalities of Ghana. Now these are things that have not really happened on a large measure and in a general form in our whole school atmosphere here. We have tried to pick personalities here and there and never ever thought that when we pick pictures today for our children in our classroom, maybe many of the children today are more influenced by what they see, the visual aids that they have at their disposal do help to mold their mind. And I think once we can develop a very blending, and I only want to use the term integration, because I don't know what it means in America, but I believe that if I can say, you know, if we try to balance our blending in terms of presentation of personality, say, of Ghana, it wasn't just President Nkrumah who really led Ghana to independence, to become an independent nation. There were a group of men and women, and you can find pictures, you can find the personal data, the history of these men and women who made Ghana together with President Nkrumah. If you can't find them in textbooks, you can't find them from bookstores, you can easily go to their mission to the UN. You are very blessed today, you have African diplomatic missions, better than you were yesterday. In fact, when you were in school, you didn't have African missions at the UN, and this could be one of the biggest problems that happened, that we weren't exposed to the kind of information that Africans themselves put out through their own government, through which they want to be reflected, because that's how they feel, that's how they are. They don't want to be interpreted to other people, through other people, or by other people. And then I have here a procedure of teaching a lesson on, say, you know, Ghana or African history and culture, especially when you deal with Ghana. First, that is the location of the map which you usually do in your classroom whenever you are dealing with this kind of subjects. And then you pinpoint the boundaries of this country. Now you will come across also against a very serious devil that is roaming around Africa, and that is the devil of reorganization of the present boundaries of African countries. You have a situation like the Biafran situation. It's a very, very decisive battle, because actually, to me, it's a very serious revolution. I just don't call it a civil war, a crisis. It's a very serious revolution because it is directing itself partly to the unjustifiable boundaries that were drawn up by the colonial power, where people of the same tribe were cut into halves and halves and put, you know, across borders, you know, unjustly by the colonial power. And I think what is happening in Nigeria today with the Biafran crisis again, and this, you know, brings up to the children to understand, you know, you have to talk about these kind of things, because they hear about it, they see them on the TV and so forth, and they wonder what's happening. But you can bring it and tie it in with your lesson plan on any country in Africa that you teach, and say, you know, and tell the children very frankly that, you know, you see boundaries that were drawn up by European nations. It's not like in America where we were able to draw up our own boundaries ourselves, just with the exception of the Spanish colonies. I don't know, maybe that's different. But here we have a continent that has been drawn up into pieces like a chessboard, but drawn up by Europeans who invaded Africa, who colonized Africa and so forth, and changed the whole character and image of Africa. You find the Biafran situation, for instance, in Nigeria, is indicative of what could happen in Africa where people of the same tribe were drawn, you know, were cut into two, some are on the other side of the border speaking French, and if you're on the same tribe, the other down on this side of the border speaking English. That somehow, if they are one tribe, something is bound to happen after independence, because those people would like to get together. But their sense of independence is that once we are independent, it means that we have to determine our own affairs according to our own conscience. And therefore, if our people were unjustly on the other side of the border, we have to decide which side we're going to be, all of us. And this is going to happen, all of us. It's a natural phenomenon. Yes.
Well, what about the whole thing with various
Biafran
tribes? Do you think that there are tribes that would like their tribal boundaries to be a country in and of itself? Is that part of the whole situation?
No, I really don't think so. I think The Afghan situation, I think, is just one most important situation in that the Afghan or the people feeling that there was a genocide campaign against them. The only refuge that they can be able to find was in invoking the sense of tribal homogeneity for the protection of all the Afghan people. You know, as they see the other Nigerians coming to destroy them. But I do not think that that is the pattern that will naturally follow in the rest of the continent where every tribe is like to have its own border.
Well, you seem to be having the same kind of situation in India right now.
We haven't had it yet. There are speculations. You know, there are speculations that it's going to happen. And I don't think those speculations are no more different than the speculations in Canada between the French and the English-speaking Canadians. When De Gaulle started promoting, you know, the French-speaking Canadians in Montreal and Toronto with the opposition party there that was opposed to the Canadian Federation, I think everybody had some sense that De Gaulle was, destroying the whole of Canada. And these are the kind of speculations that we have in regard to Africa. But at the same time, we also have to understand one thing, that when you look at the whole African complex, you should understand that most of these problems were created and designed long before independence was granted to the Africans.
I would also add to the opposite thing, that although I'm not concerned with the other factors,
yes.
Certainly,
the British alone with their oil. Maybe Standard Oil has
Well,
the
British
petroleum
is a major.
Yeah, but you know, most of these international... You have to understand one phenomenon about international cartels.
Yeah.
International cartels have a very interesting, honeymoon, and that is based on the interlocking bureaucracy.
Right.
So even if the company is in England, it doesn't necessarily really say that it doesn't exist in the United States. It may exist through individuals who are here.
Yes. Because I was thinking with the black people in America, the research in the United States, the research of the whole identification with Africa, and you mentioned in several African countries, how do the Africans feel about the black Americans?
Well, every time I get this kind of question, I don't like to talk about myself, how I feel.
No, I don't think you
necessarily.
Yes, just a minute.
Right. Well, just to give you the positive side of it, I think I should give you a very simple example. I can probably be the best propagandist that all Africans feel very close to the Afro-Americans. Because I happen to be married to an African who has been in the United States for 500 years. But we have different kinds of... what I want to tell you about the feelings of the African people towards their people here, it's really something that is very, very personal. In 1963, I was working in the diplomatic service here at the UN with the African mission, dealing with questions at the International Court of Justice. And having become tired of this whole cocktails and empty smiles and all other things, and how the world is divided between those who have the power around a cup of tea and so forth, while other people are in a conference in the UN exercising their energies in voting and thinking that they have voted for something that yields the results that were due because of their vote, not knowing that somewhere in the lobby there are tea rooms in the UN where certain men sit down who don't have any titles in their diplomatic service. They come straight from their country, like Moscow or Washington. Man without any title, and then he comes to meet Mr. X from the State Department or from, you know, Washington. And this man is a very important man, and they decide how they should divide their interests accordingly. I then decided that I really couldn't take it very much, because I was in there for about 4 years and it was just hectic. So I decided that I'll have to go back home. And I was facing one problem. The first problem being that I had been in exile, because the government had exiled me out of our country, South Africa. I can't return home unless I want my clothes to be cut. So what do I do? Where do I go to? So I decided to go to Africa. Then I said to my wife, well, there's only one other place. If you can get into South Africa and let what happens, you know, happen. Then the next thing we have to go is, I know a place in the adjacent country that is called Botswana, where we have 35,000 of our people who fled the German massacre from Southwest Africa into Botswana and sought the protection of the Botswana king against the Germans. We have to go as far as we can, close to South Africa, without entering and making Google to go into some of the South African boundaries or across their boundaries to be caught, and reach my people. Because once we are with my people, then the South Africans will find it very difficult to come in and get me. We had a baby who was just about 3 months. It's an area that I have never been, because I was born in South Africa and I'm a city person. I wasn't born in the countryside to save anything but the countryside. I was, you know, away from the country here for about 12 years. So that's enough to explain how a little bit distorted my outlook was about my own people, even though I didn't lose sight of it. So we decided that we'd cut and go. I picked up my family and we left. We traveled for 6 months before we were able to reach that place. But it was right through in the bushes, where if you want to go to a toilet, you go behind a tree or a bush, where people don't have toilet paper. You have to swim out there. And I was brought with me. An African who has been away for 500 years from Africa. And children who were attending schools here, having been in a declared terms, my children were down in relatively good schools, but the majority of the kids were white. And here they were speaking English. The exception of the baby was just 3 months old. At that place among our people, when they fled Botswana, I mean Southwest Africa, they had brought with them, with one of the early priests of the nation, a branch of one of the firewood from the holy fire, which is our religion, because we worship our ancestors. And they have come to lead the new holy fire in exile to keep the people together with that piece of wood. When we came there, we found the last living priest in charge of the holy fire there was 107 years old. He could walk on his own. He could see with his eyes, that used glasses. And as soon as I came into the village, I had to stay outside the village for about a week with my wife, because the priest had to go into meditation to talk to the ancestors and try to get my line straight and their line straight. This is a man who had never in a European school or a school. He was born and bred in that strict tradition of his own family that has cared for the holy fire of our people since time immemorial. He has never read any of the junk things that we call history and whatnot. After a week, we were brought into the village. Then we stayed there, and that whole week that we stayed there, nobody could talk to us, even me, you know, in a way that I could connect things. I felt that in English a little bit aloof of me, and I couldn't understand, but I didn't quite understand the culture, especially when it invoked the religious aspect of our people. After a week, we were asked by one of the older ladies who came to ask my wife to be ready so that she can be introduced with me to our ancestors before we can begin a normal functioning life among our people. So one early morning, we woke up and we were taken before the sun came up. We were taken into the holy fire house. And in front of the holy fire house, there is a cross. The people who keep the holy fire alive or alive are women, because women in our society are very highly respected. But no man or stranger can cross the crawl between the holy fire house and the crawl itself in between. You have to always go around to be able to come to this side where the people are. So we went into the hut, and there are calabashes, a huge hut, like a geodesic dome, just built like a geodesic dome. That's how our people have always built their homes. In the hut, there were calabashes all, you know, in a circle. And every calabash had a name of the most important homes or families that make the pillars of our nation. And each one of us, every one of us, is related to one or the other calabash among all those calabashes. And you can only drink milk from that one calabash. You cannot drink milk from the other calabash. There are other cats, if I may use their slang, who are privileged to drink milk from all other calabashes because their status in the whole stratification is different. And those are mostly young men who were born of the family of the men who have always been in the military wing of the nation. They've always commanded the army from, you know, time immemorial, and their children are brought up in that kind of service. But anyway, we went into the hut, and then the priest began to talk just to himself. And nobody was supposed to say anything. My little one was just about 4 months. He was fast asleep. The other two older ones were awake. And my wife wanted to, you know, just take Kambandi out. And the priest said, no, don't touch him because he is resting in peace with his ancestors. Those are the beautiful ones that they love. So if you disturb him, the whole atmosphere is not going to be together. I can deal with all of you. So he turned around and then he opened the door of the hut looking towards sunrise. And as the sun was coming up, it rays, he began to talk to the ancestors. First he began to laugh and smile and began to talk, and immediately he said, this is probably the most important day in my whole life that you have kept me here as the warden or the caretaker of the holy fire. Because what I have to give to you today is more precious to you than it is to me, because I'm about to join you. I have ended my journey, and I think this is indeed a great privilege or privilege for me to be able to tell you what I want to bring to you for your protection. I'm not talking about your son here. You know him, and already you have tasted the milk from the calabash of his home, and you are quite familiar with him. What I'm talking about is A daughter has come back home. She has been away 400 years. Maybe when the first white man who planted the beacon on the coast, and who was referring to the Portuguese navigators who were planting all these beacons along the African coast, that maybe when he stopped there, he found one of our young men or one of our daughters that he took with him. It is not for me to judge that. All I have to say is that a daughter has come back home, and it is up to you to protect her. Now, this I think should be enough to really relate the most intimate emotionalism that Africans have. People who have had vested interest in Africa and who have written very much about us from a European point of view have always enjoyed and glorified in the polarization of the relationship between Africans and their kings and queens overseas. Because in the glorification of that polarization is a protection of a vested interest. Thus, if black people with their technical know-how that they have been able to achieve here, with their sense of understanding and liberation from the tribal and from the parochial boundaries that we have, nationalism in Africa, for instance, it is most likely that those who would like to return to Africa, to avail this know-how to Africa, they can develop a nation out of Africa that is capable of standing on its own feet. And that can be able to also reclaim all its stolen heritage and legacy. That can be able to reconstitute and reorganize its economic institutions to benefit Africa more so than to benefit Belgians and British and Americans who have never seen our people in Africa. These people have greater vested interest in Africa, and for them to see a relationship of kith and kin reconstructed between Africans and Afro-Americans, they themselves being not of our generation, being not liberated, all that they see is a threat to their vested interest in the African continent that they have had a privilege of exploiting. That is where everywhere where you go, you find people throwing out all kinds of things that somehow Afro-Americans and Africans view each other in different terms. In fact, I've always said, if a Jewish person, and I don't say all the Jewish people are for Israel, but if for those who are for Israel, are for Israel, then certainly I see no reason why an Afro-American should not be for Africa. Not necessarily that he wants to go and live there, but he can certainly have his whole sense of perspective, sense of identity and originality reconstructed to be relevant to his role even in this country. And probably in becoming more aware and reconstructing his own relationship with Africa, his position here will be much better respected, because he has a place as an alternative to go to if the system doesn't want him here. It's not like yesterday when an Afro-American can be kicked around, and on the understanding and conviction of that man who kicks him around, that after all, where can they go to? They are Negro. But if they are Afro-Americans or African-Americans, or they are black people, that they have accepted themselves to be, and have begun to reclaim their original name, walking around with their original identity and so forth, certainly, there is something very serious that we have to look at, and that is this new realignment of the new internationalism of the black people's consciousness that is taking place today, not only in America, not only in Africa, but also in South America and the Caribbean. It's a very, very important revelation of a new black nation to come into existence that is going to stand on its own feet together on equal terms with all other nations of the earth to be here together or for all of us to disappear.
I don't know, I don't want to throw the discussion off in wrong directions, but I've had a question percolating in my mind for many years. We had a conference here once. I wish I remembered the name of the speaker who was here studying with Martha Graham. He was a dancer. And he talked about the traditional African education and talked about the sense of rhythm that was sort of ever-present in a child's life, and how this was a quality in the education in terms of the speech, in terms of actual body movement, and so on and so forth. And it, what he said sounded so much like the ideas that we have here in modern education of the place of rhythm built into the life of people. And it seemed to me that that was something that I wanted to know more about, and whether this was characteristic of all traditional education in Africa or his particular area, I don't know. But I just wondered if you could comment on that.
You know, when you deal with this whole area of education, and knowing very well what has been said and developed in terms of ideas, some of which are wrong ideas, sometimes you really have a very serious problem of clarifying certain things. I met a friend in Paris who was one of the greatest black ballet dancers, and he was a teacher at the same time. And one day we were having tea, and he had some of his colleagues from his school. We're just talking, you know, the same cultural thing. And one of the girls, a Parisian girl, asked him and said, "Floyd, it is natural that you have to be the best ballet dancer, you know." So he said, "What do you mean natural?" So she kept going and said, "Well, I mean, you know, black people were born with this rhythm. They were, you know, in Africa you get it from way down there, whereas we don't get it." And I think, you know, he gave us the most beautiful answer that I could have even wanted to give. And that is, "It's too bad you were late in getting it. You have to blame your parents. Because every human being, let's get away from the whole thing that black people have certain inherent virtues, you know, a way of walking, a way of rhythm, a way of dancing, a way of adapting to this kind of stereotype thinking, you know, that has made it possible during the history of slavery to turn our people into, you know, tap dancers for the entertainment of the plantation owner, you know, and dancing and things like that, musical instruments, playing drums and all kinds of mimicking kind of things, you know." And I really think that basically all human beings have rhythm.
Yeah, well, I wasn't saying what you were saying, but I'm saying something else.
I'm just trying to, you know, I think basically all human beings have rhythm. But the advantage that probably we have in Africa is that since traditionally we were not completely colonized and destroyed, and many things that exist in our cultures continue to exist from the village right through to the city. And since many of us are also born from the countryside coming to the cities and so forth, there is this whole mobility of back and forth movement from the cities and from the countryside to the cities and so on. I think we have been more fortunate in that we have always lived with our culture. And when you come over to the Western Hemisphere, you also find latent qualities that are of African characteristics among Afro-Americans, for example. And they live with many things that whites don't live with. And there's a degree of a difference of education and bringing up at home that limits the European kids in certain aspects that do not exist in the black community. Whereas there are also certain qualities and certain things that left in the black children because of the economic nature, you know, and the situation that they have been forced to live under, which you find in Whitefield. And what we, I think, have to address ourselves to today is a complete reorganization of our whole educational system. It's really a gigantic task. But I say that if the Chinese could do it in 67, 68, 69, with their cultural revolution, and still be able to get away with it, no matter what anybody says about the cultural revolution in China, about other political aspects, there was one fundamental question when I was in China that was actually developing within that whole cultural revolution thing, and that was the education of the Chinese child to make him more relevant to China and probably also to the rest of mankind, but as a Chinese. And I think if the Chinese could go through this confusion and not end up with a complete disintegration of China, we can certainly, you know, probably do better, if not like any of them. I don't know how we can go about it.
Yeah, well, there are two things here that I think are important. Number one, that there should be some way in which American education could learn from the traditional African education for its own benefit. The other thing is that in the process of having American children understand African culture, that dance should be one of the very important ways in which an American child gets the feeling for African culture into his whole body. Mm-hmm. Do you, I assume that you do that in teaching children, in black and white children in New York City. Could you comment on what is done and how it works?
You know, the center that I was working with, we had a dancing department which dealt with almost every aspect of dancing with kids. But what I found out, which was one of my hang-ups in fact, and liabilities at the same day, that we were dealing with children coming on visit. And then I concocted a little program on Saturday dealing with a stable group of toddies, just little toddies, on Saturday, and studying not only with ballet and flamenco, but Afro-Caribbean, you know, Afro-Cuban, African music, and every form of dancing. And I began drifting more to the table experimental, you know, program in dancing with the little ones than I was, you know, more interested with the older ones. The older ones were quite aware, they were hip, you know, considering the whole life today, in schools and outside schools and whatnot. But for my people, I think I wanted to find out more what really we were doing to our children in general, starting from that early age. The things we have been able to deprive them, which they try to catch up with at a later time, you know, date when they are older than they were, when we could have taken the advantage when they were really quite the kind of age that could be adapted in every form that we wanted to. And I think what we really have to do here is our education here the education in the United States has to radically change and begin to consider the most serious part of the child age being the first year and the second year. Like on slowly coming to the third, but basically the first and the second year. These are the most important formative years of children. I think whatever we deprive of children at that time, we deprive them forever. And whatever we try to organize, we have to organize it in such a way that we can probably take from African institutions and all other institutions of the people of the world. And since this country is made up of people from all parts of the world, I think you have the ingredients right on hand here. I just don't understand sometimes why people are fussy about the whole question of reorganizing education and making it more relevant today. Maybe it's because things develop to such a point that when you look at the Board of Education, somebody is in the Board of Education. When you talk about, you know, changing the educational system, it thinks in terms of, well, if we change and they begin to change the books and so forth, is the company John Bill Brown going to get the kind of, you know, contract that the Board of Education has been enjoying, from which I have been able to get my 10% commission and so forth? And we are really caught in a very serious thing that even if you look at the catalog of the Board of Education books, I can say 3/4 of the books that are, you know, recommended in the catalog need to be completely revised by people in the schools who are involved in the school system, to substitute them with books that they think they can use in their schools. And most of these books, at the end of the year, before we start the new year, you can go to the backyard of schools and find how many textbooks are there to give room to new textbooks that are coming in that are also as trashy as those that we burn at the end of the year. This is the kind of problem. So when we talk about organization, I think we are talking about a formidable challenge before American educators and teachers.
Well, I would like to see if we can't work out some sort of a continuing relationship where, say, we want to try certain things, and
right,
if you could help us
like
this, I'd like to see us looking forward to the use of dams and other areas and see
when
if
I'm
we couldn't...
About business,
what's that?
Digressing to business, right? Business.
No, I'm not talking about business now. I'm talking about ideas.
Yes, I'll try to be as helpful as I can.
Because, and I don't want to put you out in front here and commit you to something. I didn't mean that at
right.
all. But I just mean that right now I just have the idea, and I'm expressing it, that it would be good to try to look forward to working out something in a long-term way in which this really gets into the fiber of the
right.
school.
Can you write down the name of Professor Carol Primus?
She taught a course here this summer, and she I've known her for many
right.
years.
Well,
yeah.
I think she's there.
Well, now, what does a teacher do, like me? I mean, you're going to be doing a unit on Africa in my 4th grade, and I don't know how to do African dancing, and I would love to learn enough to teach my class some things, or at least be able to get my hands on somebody who would teach. What do I do?
Yeah, well, we're fortunate we have people in the school where even little Kelly Jones herself could do it.
Yeah, but
yeah.
Kelly
Jones
can't. That's
yeah.
not enough.
No, we have to have.
No,
we're
not fortunate because I don't know what to do. Now, what do I
there
do?
There are very few groups that I think I can recommend to you that can really benefit your school here in terms of the whole area of dancing in Africa. One of them is the Ishangi dancers.
How do you spell
it? ISHANGI. I don't have the address offhand, but I can try to look around for it. I think I have it at home. I like them for one reason. They do not just come to the classroom to try to demonstrate themes in African dancing and rhythm and whatnot. Every dance that they present, they have a lecture for the teachers, for the students involved. They tell you from the first movement to the last movement what all those movements represent. And they are probably one of the best groups that I have seen so far. And the second person, of course, is Carol Carmen, who is an authority in her field, and she has spent a long time in Africa in learning this thing. The other person that I can also suggest is Olatunji.
Yes.
Now, he has several records. Now, I don't know whether you can find it very easy to get Hugh Masekela. I don't know that you haven't heard of the name.
He used to be a father in that school.
He used to go to X.
Yeah. Why I made you so bad in name?
We all
are. But when you have a complicated population like this, some of the Chinese, some of the Japanese. There's one person that I can recommend to you who has done a joint group with Michael Olavin, that is Professor Elizabeth Dick, at Brooklyn College, in the Education Department. She wants somebody to be able to talk to you about the transplantation of African music right through the Caribbean to the United States, South America. She's a very lovely person. In fact, I had a workshop last week with her. Now, yeah, what I was trying to say is that I don't know whether it would be possible for you to get Schumann together. Why I suggested Schumann together is because he represents the modernized African industrial life or urban life. And through him, you can see a blending of African traditional music with the urban music and culture. And I think he's just the best of all the artists that I have met.
Were you going to say something?
I'm just
going to,
pick up a comparison. I've been quite friendly with Chinese people, a couple of big friends that were born and raised in China or in Austin. And all of them can use paintbrush like nobody did. I mean, somebody again here at a very early age, because that's where they were. The same way with the rhythm and the music are, I'm sure the two-step as a young boy who gets down there and do one, you can't imagine it, but that is like baseball in a Russian village, and that's dance, the folk dance, and I think you're right, that there's so many things that we don't expose. I don't think that it should be done, it's a painful. I mean, it's too much for certain things, but exposure people on appropriate level to things, and then you have to learn to keep them small because
Well, I can see a certain pattern here. For instance, for many years we've had associated with the school an Indian, Catawba Indian, Red Thundercloud. We have in our sixth grade a teacher who is of India and who knows Indian dancing. Seems to me that if the Board of Education would like a suggestion from me, that there ought to be a whole series of traveling specialists who go from school to school bringing the authentic ethnic culture of various parts of the world to the schools. That would be a wonderful thing. And that's the kind of thing I think that schools have to work toward. Having in some areas, you certainly can't cover the whole world, but significant parts of the world. There are people who can help teachers to bring this to their children. And I think that
it means, again, that you must watch again falling into the problem of curiosity, entertainment.
Yeah, that's right.
Unless we have something specifically permanent in the curriculum, such a program can help
right.
to complement what you have in the curriculum.
Precisely.
It can be an ongoing thing. It is a follow-up.
Yeah.
Even when they leave, you have something in the curriculum, you follow up. Otherwise, you become just another
yeah.
you know,
bad. And I would think that in a school, if you're really going to introduce African culture as seriously as, say, European culture is in our schools, that all the teachers should be involved in this dance program,
mm-hmm.
and that everybody should get the feel of this, and as you say, that it has to be built into the curriculum. It can't be a little frosting on the top of the cake.
Yes.
If I
have
digressed and wanted to go back to something that you spoke about before in terms of nationalism. I think that this is a source for confusion. I certainly have seen and read it on the in campus, young people who live on longer campus, between the white and the black, where, not that I disagree with anything you say, because I think this is certainly where it's at for the black people, but for the white people, it's particularly beyond like they have had it with a nationalism in terms of American nationalism, in terms of the oppressiveness of the American nation, let's say in places like Vietnam and Africa and all over the world. And talk more or think more in terms of the human race, so to speak, that never mind, you know, where you what was the old for textbook and turn now, turn where you come from, or what your culture is like. If you are a man, you are a human being, you have as much right to live as a man, no matter what the background. And I think it has been a source of confusion in that we are in different places, we are in the same campus, but we are in different places in history and evolution. See what I'm getting at. So while this is certainly correct, place for these black people to be, and this is a necessary step before one can talk about the human race and the history as one, so to speak. I think that people are troubled by this, and that we sometimes alienate each other as a result of this confusion, and could stand a great deal of clarity. Now, how you want to bring it into classroom, whether it could be in an elementary school classroom, I don't know, although I think there is a confusion to the nurse on that.
Mm-hmm. I think the kids understand one another, and they are trying their hardest best to understand one another and be relevant to one another. And I think the only liability they have is us, their parents. They have left us way, way behind. And we still, you know, do not want to face our own failures. When we look at our children, we feel so small in their eyes when they make us to recognize our failures in terms of their progress and their forward movement. And hence you find that presence even on the question of the ethics. I mean, not many young people who are there fighting really understand the oppressiveness of Vietnam. The very fact that they can go into villages and mow down women and children and only come to be alerted by this, and only through that group, even you know, among that whole group, only one of them had a feeling that was a doubtful feeling whether he was doing the right thing, you know. The young man took pictures of the whole incident and showed it to us. Right. Now, you know, when you look at so many young people right there in Vietnam, not in America, right there in Vietnam, doing or made to do the things they're doing there, and only about 100 of them will fast on the day of Thanksgiving, refuse to eat, 100 of them out of 500,000 young people that we have in Vietnam, you know, then there's something very serious for us to think about. It means that the kind of education that we have given the children here must be a very fantastic, horrible education. Yes. And only useful to whom? Not to you, the parents of those children who are dragged into this war.
Yes.
Vietnam is a horrible thing to think about, that it can happen today, you know. But maybe it could have only taken America to have Vietnam to awaken the conscience of American people in general about themselves and about their own environment, their own children. Maybe nothing else. And I think even the Korean War didn't have that kind of impact that the Vietnamese War had on the whole American people in general. But with the kids, if they are black kids, and they are in their thing of nationalism, I think well and good, because it helps to shake up their fellow, you know, men in the classroom or outside in the street or on campuses and so forth. But you find even where you go, I teach a class in African and Afro-American history and American curriculum. And I have a 50-60 class. I have 50 black kids and 50 white kids. There were times when we did not run. We scramble around in special services. And my course is open to community people and, you know, teachers and students, so you can take it for credit or not for credit. That's how I was able to get the course anyway, to take the course. But you know, what I'm trying to say is that there are issues at times in our classroom, like the meaning of a policeman to a white child and to a black child. Does a policeman have two meanings and two images? I have never been involved in a very serious emotional discussion where we don't think anymore, but we think we feel it, you know, on everybody's part. And everybody is right, because they see the policeman functioning exactly in the way they are telling me, or they are telling one another. I see a policeman in the one community functioning differently, right, and so forth. I see 10 cops in Harlem always together, not one cop. And the way he moves around and so forth.
That's so polite, and
wait a minute. And then, one child said, yeah, when those things come into our community, was a black student, and immediately a handful of white students got on her neck. You don't call them pigs. Not all white people are pigs, and so forth. You know, they couldn't get out of this. And you know, another white kid in the back says, "Ah, what are you talking about? We call them pigs, all of us, because that's what they are." And that's a white kid. And immediately, you know, you begin to work that kind of atmosphere to be able to come to the essence of what you wanted to bring up. And that is the question mark of the role of the policeman, what it should be in our community. You know? And you come down to it. And you find that everywhere where you go, it's no wonder that the Panthers have, you know, an alliance with the SDS students, you know, and all other white groups and so forth that they consider progressive and whatnot. But these kids are way ahead of us. They understand more, and they have decided that they're just going to take things and life in their own hands, things we have faced them so much. And when they look at our own educational system, they don't even see anything better. They see the worst of it, because they see us trying to mold them in things that they don't want to be, and that is us. They don't want to be like us. They just want to be their own people in the making of their own images, and nobody should do, you know, what he felt or thought was good for him, and, you know, for General Motors, therefore it's good for them. They just don't want it. And that's why they are challenging every aspect of the institutions as they are today. I went to the south, and I went to the Appalachian Mountains there. At least I found a handful of white kids who were members of the SDS, and it was quite a revelation for me. But this country, you know, I always say, the best of representative democracy here was not a one birth. You gave birth to two twins. Representative democracy and racism. And unless we go back to that policy and get it straight out, we're tired. And that's why when you talk about the history of slavery, we are always afraid of talking about the depth of what happened, you know. We are always afraid of bringing in the classroom pictures of black people who were hanging on trees and lynched and on firewood and so forth to the kids to see. Because, you know, we have this distorted understanding and view of Christianity, you know. Our whole so-called Christian ethics are so wrongly directed, their sources of references are so wishy-washy, that we only come to begin to invoke them when we want to deny the true knowledge to the children. That's the time that we become the self-righteous people, you know. And we're so self-righteous about it, even at the extent of destroying our own children.
And everybody in that area is white. I never hear about it. Thank you.